Good afternoon to everyone. It is certainly a privilege to be here with you this afternoon on this holy day, and I hope everyone's holy day season is off to a good start. I want to issue a reclaimer from last week. I had the announcements, and several people came up to me afterwards, and they said, "You said the last day was the last great day of unleavened bread." And I said, "It could be, right? Right? I'm hopeful it's going to be a great day, but I just wanted to throw that out there because several people, and it's amazing. I have a lot of latitude, I guess, for people who speak a lot. And I think about this, you know, the current presidential campaign. Could you imagine being out in the public spotlight for over a year saying things? I mean, you're invariably going to trip over things. So again, I'm throwing that out there, so you'll be easy on me today when something invariably goes sideways. But I wanted to throw that out there first of all. I'm not changing doctrine, none of that stuff. So it is the last. Let me see if I can get it right. Last day of unleavened bread, which will be on Friday. Okay. And it's going to be great. I certainly appreciate the offertory music. I think if they had passed the basket a second time, I would have put more money in there. It's a very, very inspiring piece of music. And as well, the choir, beautiful piece as well. I know there's a lot of work and effort that goes into that. So thank you for all of you who are involved with making that happen. And again, we're extremely blessed, I always say that, in our area to have so many people and so much talent that can bring music like that and praise to God. So it's a wonderful, wonderful thing. Well, I'd like to start this afternoon by reading an article from the New York Times from January 18th, 1994. It says, from Los Angeles, January 17th, a violent earthquake jolted millions of people out of bed before dawn today, crumpling freeway overpasses, leveling buildings, and igniting scores of fires. Hundreds of people were injured, and at least 24 were reported killed, including 14 at a three-level apartment complex that was reduced to two stories. The quake, centered in the Northridge area of the San Fernando Valley, 20 miles northwest of downtown L.A., measured 6.6 on the Richter scale of ground motion and was felt for hundreds of miles, knocking out power, water service for hundreds of thousands of residents. In a region held together by a network of freeways, three overpasses collapsed, crippling major highways for weeks and possibly months. Roads cracked and buckled across the San Fernando Valley. State of emergency was declared. People lingered in the streets throughout the day as thuds of aftershocks sent dust rising above the mountains. Others formed long lines outside hardware stores and tried to buy batteries, water, propane, or plywood to repair damaged homes. And when evening came, hundreds of people whose homes were destroyed or too dangerous to re-enter camped in city parks and on tennis courts in a nervously festive atmosphere, with some of them with campfires and cases of beer. So that's an excerpt from New York Times of something that happened back in 1994. My wife Donna and I were there during that earthquake. And I remember it quite vividly. It was, this article doesn't speak about it, but it was 4:31 a.m. when the earthquake hit. And I don't wish an earthquake upon anyone, but if you have not experienced an earthquake, it is the best way I can describe it. It's like a freight train coming from underground through your body, through the building. And I thought about this morning. I thought they should probably create alarm clocks with that sound, because it will instantaneously get you out of bed. Now, I was sleeping on the side of the bed that was closest to our bedroom door. My wife is counting the offering, so this is just between us, all right? She got out of bed and trampled me to get to that doorway. All right? She was safely under the doorway. I dragged my beaten-up body out of the bed and stumbled over to the doorway. A little bit of blood was coming off the corner, you know, just like the movies, right? So I'm standing there thinking, I don't know if the internal bleeding's going to be the problem or what's going to happen here. Will I die because of that? So we stood there. Don't tell her this, please. So we stood in this doorway, and as we stood there, you could literally see the walls moving back and forth. You could hear this rumble. And I literally at that point thought, we are going to die. We're going to die. As this article, and we lived at that time in a three-story apartment building. We lived on the first floor, right above the carport. This article talks about 14, it actually turned out to be 28 people who died in a very, very similar three-story apartment that collapsed. And we lived there, and they talk about aftershocks and things that, just so in case you're wondering, we did live. We got out all right. But that moment of terror, and then the aftershocks, they had people that lived in parks for 2 weeks afterwards because they were afraid to go back inside, afraid to go back inside the structure. And I point this out because you can read an article like this and it's factual. And you get the facts and you understand there was an earthquake. But if I tell you our experience now is real, there's a reality behind that story, isn't there? And that's why you hear, I remember at the time, people would call into radio stations. It happens all the time, right? You get that personal account. Oh, I was sitting here and all the china came off and the bookshelf, right? That personal account was what makes it real, right? It makes a story come to life. And if we had time, we'd go around the room and I bet each one of us has something that's unique. And if we heard that, we'd be riveted. We say, what a fact, you were there when that happened or you saw that. That's what makes it interesting. The Bible is very similar to that. That's what makes the Bible very interesting. The Bible is filled with first-hand accounts of things that are pretty amazing. You think of the fiery furnace, right? Or you think of the lion's den. Or you think of these events that happen in the Bible, and sometimes you think about, wow, what would happen if I were in that spot? I play that game with the kids sometime. Would you rather have gone to the fiery furnace or the lion's den? All right? I never give them great choices, but it's like, yeah, which of those would you have rather have been in, right? But we read accounts in the Bible, and it's that firsthand experience that makes the Bible come to life. People who interacted with God in the Old Testament, right? Like Samuel, where God called for him, right? I don't think any of us have had that experience. But it makes for good reading, right? The Bible is good that way because we look at it and it comes to life. It's not a distant article, right? It has a lot of feeling and people involved. And we can relate to that. And we wonder, we say, how would I have been as an Israelite in that same situation, right? Where God said, just stand still. And Moses is like, we're at the parting of the Red Sea. He says, you know, just stand still. You're going to be fine. I'll take, you know, those situations, you picture yourself there. We know the ending now, but when you're going through it, it's a little different. When we were standing there that morning and that thought raced through my mind, we might die. You don't know how it's going to end. That's what makes it interesting. That's why the Bible is interesting. Well, this afternoon I want to talk about one account, of a first-hand account, a reality of someone who spent time with Jesus Christ. And sometimes it's easy for us to not understand that or think that through fully, but people who walked and spent time with Jesus Christ. What can you imagine that firsthand reality? If you've seen that, if you talked with, if you spent time with Jesus Christ, what a different experience than reading a distant account of that. So this afternoon I want to spend a little time looking at something from a person who spent time with Jesus and how that impacts us here today on the first day of Unleavened Bread. Turn with me, if you would, to the book of 1 John. 1 John. And I want to look at something here this afternoon on this day of unleavened bread. And I guess I'll start out by piquing your interest a little bit and say, what if I, this afternoon, was able to give you a formula to help us develop one of the fruits of God's Spirit? What if I was able to give you a formula that says, if we do this, we'll have X? I like formulas, right? 2 + 2 = 4. Unless in my world, if you want it to be something different, we can talk about that too, right? But for the most part, formulas work a certain way, and they're comforting in that sense. There's a formula here that lays out something that will help us develop one of the fruits of God's Spirit. One of the fruits I think that is important in this Holy Day season of Unleavened Bread. Turn with 1 John, the first chapter. John, 1 John 1 and verse 1. That which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked upon, and our hands have handled concerning the word of life. He's talking here about Jesus Christ. He said, I'm going to tell you about someone who I spent time with, who I saw, who I heard, who I even handled. All right? The book of John. He wrote John, 1 John, 2 John, 3 John, and Revelation. Most scholars agree upon that. The names are sort of a dead giveaway, but most scholars are and say that John wrote the first book of John. He wrote this about 85 or 90 AD, right? Almost 60 years after Jesus Christ had lived. That's a big span of time. That's like us going back to 1955 and talking about something that happened there. So he's saying, so picture the time that's passed, and we're going to go into this a little bit, but he's writing, addressing very specific things that this group of people would be facing or were facing 60 years after Jesus Christ had died and ascended back to God the Father. So he's saying, I'm going to tell you about a real reality about this person who I saw and heard and handled, who was the Word. In verse 2, the life was manifested and we have seen and bear witness and declare to you that eternal life which was with the Father and was manifested to us. We were there, we saw it, we partook of it. That which we have seen and heard, we declare to you, that you also may have fellowship with us, and that truly our fellowship is with the Father and with His Son, Jesus Christ. And these things we write to you that your joy may be full. Here's the formula that he gives to us. He talks about, I'm going to tell you about this person I spent time with, the Son of God. No ordinary experience. We lived it. He manifested himself to us. And now we have fellowship with him. And because we have fellowship with him, we have joy. So the formula he lays out is, when we fellowship with God the Father and Jesus Christ, it results in a joy that is full, a joy that is complete. That word fellowship comes from the Strong's 2842, and it's spelled K-O-I-N-O-N-I-A, koinonia. That word literally means partnership. Partnership, communion. To become an associate, a companion, a partner. It's a very, very powerful and a strong word. When it says we come into fellowship with God the Father, what he's talking about here is that we are now a partner. We're a companion. We're working in tandem with God the Father and Jesus Christ and what they are trying to do. What an amazing concept he is talking about, because we talk about, we look back to where we were before the Passover and everything we've done, we were unreconciled. We talked about that several weeks ago. Unreconciled, but then Jesus Christ comes, gives his life, and reconciles us. In a sense, he closes that bridge that we heard about in the sermonette that's caused by sin. Nothing that we do. It's not a process. It's an act where Jesus Christ gives his life, sheds his blood, and the only way possible, takes away that distance and says, I'm going to call you now into fellowship, to partner with me, to share in my work, to have a commonality, to have a union. And if we do that, if you do that, that's what John is saying here, if you fellowship in God the Father and Jesus Christ, your joy will be full. Your joy will be complete. A joy that is so elusive sometimes as we try to understand, where does that joy emanate? How does that joy come? John lays it out here. He says that is the basis of it. That's what causes that to happen. You can just jot this down. We read this at the Passover. 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 16. It talks about taking that communion. When we take of the body and the blood, we have a communion. Remember I said communion? We have a partnership. We have a fellowship. We've entered now into the same work that Jesus Christ and God the Father have entered into. It's God the Father, Jesus Christ, and put your name, you know, limited liability partnership, right? On top of the building, right? It's not a loose association. It's not something where he says, I want to get with you once in a while. No, it's full partnership, right? That's where that comes. Now we're involved with something that is so past what we could have thought of before when we were unreconciled, where sin had separated us. Now, there's a show we like to watch. I don't know. Have you ever watched Shark Tank? No one's going to raise their hand. All right. No, I got you. Okay. Once in a while, we like it, and the kids like it, and it's good for business and that. But they'll go on the show and say, okay, for 20%, for $200,000, I want 20% of your company. Right? They want, they're a shark. They want to work something, work a deal with you. Well, it's a little different what Jesus and God the Father say. They say, God said, I'm going to send my son. the best, 100% of what I could give. I'm all in. I'm giving everything. I'm giving my son to come, pay the price for you, and in return, I want 100%. I want 100% of you. 100% ownership. That's what he's talking about here when he says we enter into that fellowship. And you're going to see the way John writes here. He writes in a very black and white style. You're in, you're out. Right? That mindset you're going to see from John. He's going to talk about concepts. I think I always say the Bible is not difficult that way. The concepts are easy. Sometimes the choices are tough. But John's going to talk about light, darkness, love, hate. 100% in. 0% in. Right? That's what he's talking about in this partnership here. And a partnership that brings us to a spot where we were without hope. It's amazing how it's changed. It's almost like a Cinderella story. We had nothing to offer, nothing to give, and now we're transformed. We've got this name on a building that's got your name with God and Jesus Christ in partnership. That's what he's saying. There's great joy in that situation. Right? That's the formula that he lays out here in the first couple of verses. I remember back to a statement Mr. Armstrong would make years ago. He made the statement that said, you probably remember this, the level of our conversion is directly related to how much our heart is in the work. Mr. Armstrong saying that years ago. And I remember I was hearing that and I thought about it again this week. Well, John is saying something very, very similar. He would say, the level of our conversion is dependent on how much we are fellowshipping with God the Father and Jesus Christ. How much we are partnering with what they are trying to do, the work. Right? The level of our conversion is going to be evident in what? Those fruits of the Spirit. Joy. Peace. That's what John is saying. As we partner with God, as we get involved, as we fellowship more with Him, joy is a result. The level of our conversion is starting to be transformed because now we are with the best business plan that we could enter into. The most important thing that we could involve ourselves with. If you notice what John says here in verse, let's just look here at verse 3. He says, that which we have seen and we heard, we declare to you that you also may have fellowship with us, as truly our fellowship is with God the Father. You see the way it works? It emanates from the top. He's saying, hey, we have fellowship with God the Father and Jesus Christ, and we want you to have that fellowship, that shared fellowship with us. Our fellowship with God the Father and Jesus Christ is the basis for the fellowship we have with each other. If we don't have that, we don't have a basis of fellowship with each other. That's the reality that John is laying out here. There's nothing else of importance. So he said, come join us. Come join us in this partnership. You always hear of limited liability. This is more of a corporation. We're going to take on, he's taking on more people into this. That becomes the basis of our fellowship. I think back to my college days and, there was a very, very special situation. I don't know if I may have mentioned this one time before, but I was going to college in upstate New York about 6 hours from home, so I didn't really have a way to get home every weekend. And this was back in the old days when we had very, very large congregations, except for the one I was attending was in upstate New York, and it was probably only about 70 people. So I was a little bit in the middle of nowhere, about an hour from church, but there was a gentleman there who gave me a ride to church. I remember the very first Sabbath. I caught a ride with him. He was going to meet me on campus. I was in full suit Saturday morning. All these guys are playing football. I'm walking across campus with my suit and my Bible, right? So it was hard when you're 18 years old, right? So we went to church with him, but then a family took me under their wing and they came usually on Friday afternoons. They would pick me up and they would usually bring me home either Saturday night if I had something going on or Sunday. But I look back with great fondness as an 18-year-old young man. The hours we spent on Friday nights talking of the things of God, the hope we had, the things that we read about in the Bible, the excitement there, because our fellowship together, our commonality we shared at that table was because we both had fellowship with God the Father and Jesus Christ. Apart from that, they were a family that lived an hour from where I went to school. There would have been no union, No connection. But there were, I was there for 3 years, and I think of the time they would come an hour each way and pick me up. And we had great fellowship because of that. It was during that period I was baptized. It was a real connection point. And it wasn't because we spent time talking about school. We did at times, obviously, and dreams and different things in their family. But the real core, the real glue were the things of God, the things of Jesus Christ, the things that motivate us, the things that stirred us, the things that excited us, the things of the kingdom that resonated with us, the hopes we had, the things we were excited to learn about and share with each other and talk about. What does that translate into? That's what John is talking about, joy. You can probably see it in my expression. I look back at those times in a very, very fond way. Fond people will always be near and dear to my heart because of that time and that relationship and that bond we had discussing God's word and the hope that we had and we shared inside of us. You have that quite often at the feast. I remember so many times having discussions with people in sometimes far-flung areas, and they're wanting to desire and devour the word and be in fellowship with God. And we have that here. And when we have that, we know that's the depth of the greatest fellowship we have. When we have those moments when we are in union, that's what drives the basis of our relationship with each other. And then when our fellowship is in with God, and we have that fellowship with each other, then our activities flow from that, but the activities are very secondary, aren't they? Because we could have activities with anybody. When you think about it, we could just, neighbors, I got some great neighbors, some co-workers, we could have those activities. But it's all part of that package because of what we share in common. That fellowship in God the Father and Jesus Christ, and the activities we have are all centered around that. And that hope, and that what we do with our young people in the classes and bringing them up in that fellowship. That's what John is talking about here. What a wonderful, wonderful story. So it's real simple, right? That's the end of the sermon. We just do that and have fellowship in God the Father, Jesus Christ. You have joy. We can turn the speaker off when we're done, right? Why doesn't it always work that way, right? If that was the case, John just writes that, but he writes a 5-chapter epistle here. Because unfortunately, John lays out, back to formulas again, he lays out another formula. He said, listen, if you have fellowship with God the Father and Jesus Christ, you're going to have joy. But he also says, look what he says in verse 6. If we say that we have fellowship in him and walk in darkness, we lie and do not practice the truth. He talks about a situation where if we walk in darkness, guess what? We can't have fellowship with him. And by extension, if you do your math, this formula, then this formula comes out. If we walk in darkness, we don't have fellowship. We don't have fellowship. We don't have joy. Sin robs joy. I make that statement for our young people in particular because that is not the message you hear in society today. Sin can sometimes be equated with joy. Sometimes the effects aren't seen. Sometimes the effects don't seem real. Sometimes it feels like the effects are never going to come. So we're sold a message that you can sin and still have joy. But John is not saying that. It's a very deceptive message that's put out there by Satan. It's a hook for all of us that somehow you can have it all. You can do those things and have it. But John is saying very clearly, if you do that, if you walk in darkness and you claim, he comes very boldly, and you're going to see that here. He says, no, that's a lie. You're a liar. Right? Very bold. Sometimes we go, ooh, I want that middle ground where it's like, you know, if you're sort of doing this and doing that, maybe God thinks this way. He lays out some pretty sharp lines when he talks about it. That's the thing that short circuits it. How do we know that's a truism? Well, you only have to go back to Genesis in the Garden of Eden, right? You don't just jot that down in Genesis 3. When Adam and Eve sinned, what did they do first thing? They hid themselves, right? Separation from that fellowship now, right? There's guilt. At some point, when that sin runs its cycle and comes full circle, that joy is gone. Now all the things that are bad about that, the shame, the guilt, all start to settle in. Because that fellowship is not there. That partnership. If you're a partner, And some of you have your own businesses and you have partners, or you've worked even in the corporate world where you're trying to, you need to be lockstep with your partner, right? There's no way to have different agendas and have that partnership work out. That's what he's talking about here. He said, you can't say that you are in partner with God. You walk into that building that says God and Jesus Christ in your last name and then do these things over here. That's going to blow up the partnership. That's not going to end in a very joyful spot. That's what John is describing here. He's saying it's just not going to work that way. That's not the way it can work out. I think it's also interesting to understand the backdrop when you read a book in the Bible, what is being talked about and who is being talked to, right? What is John talking about here? Who is he writing this to? I will just say that a lot of the things you read in 1 John are addressing a movement that was becoming very popular at that time called Gnosticism. It's a hard word to spell. Do you know the first letter in that? No. N? No. No, G, actually. But Gnosticism was the belief that any spiritual was good. Anything of matter was basically evil. Right? So you're going to see how this plays into what John is talking about. Remember, 60 years after Jesus Christ had walked the earth, John is writing this letter. In 60 years' time, a lot of error can creep in. In today's world, in about 60 minutes, right, a lot of things start to creep in and start to work on that fellowship, break that down, chisel it off, get us to a different spot where we say, yeah, we're walking still with God the Father. Yeah, we have that part. But John would say, do we? That's what he's asking here. He says certain things here he's addressing with this Gnosticism. And I'll just give you a couple things that were sort of the big highlights of that belief. One of the things where they said, the body doesn't matter, so guess what? If the body doesn't matter, you can do whatever. Good or bad. You can sin freely because the physical piece doesn't really matter. And that's why John is saying here in verse 6, he says, if we say we have fellowship and walk in darkness, we lie. People say, it doesn't really matter. I can still have fellowship and live my life in sin. That was Gnosticism. One of the things they espoused with that belief system. It was also knowledge-based, very knowledge-based, saying, okay, if I'm going to live my life, I need to experience the best of everything and the worst of everything. Right? I need to get knowledge on all that, gather that knowledge. That's why John in verse 5 says, this is the message which we have heard from him and declare to you that God is light, and in him is no darkness at all. There's no room for exploring the darkness and going to that spot. He's very much directing a lot of these beliefs. There was a belief of being entirely spiritual. I'm so spiritual, I'm above sin. I'm at the spiritual plane right now. Sin really can't, it's not really part of my world. Not part of my equation. But what does he say in verse 8? If we say we have no sin, we deceive ourselves. The truth is not in us. It was also the belief there was a release of the Spirit through an elaborate and esoteric knowledge. You know, if I just gathered all this knowledge, my spirit would be released from this trapped, horrible physical body, and I would be at this spiritual level. But guess what? You know what? I can probably get there, but a lot of ordinary people, some of you guys probably can't get there. So it's only for a certain group of people who are going to get to this spot. Well, does that sound like a unifying, love-filled situation? What does he say in John 2 and verse 9? He who says he's in the light and hates his brother is in darkness until now. So many things that John is addressing. Even the very first verse we talked about in John 1:1, he goes, I'm going to talk about a man who lived and came in the flesh, because Gnosticism believed as well that Jesus Christ didn't really come in the physical body. He had an appearance. He really couldn't have suffered on the cross because he really wasn't physical. And John said, no, he was here. We saw him. We heard him. I handled him. It was the Word in John 1:14, the Word that came and became flesh. Right? So here's John saying, if you want fellowship, if you want joy, do these things. But I got this whole group of people now who are introducing all these other things in the appearance. We can live this way, be this way, have our own little system set up and say we walk in that fellowship. He says, no, that's not the light. That's darkness. That's sin. And that's going to rob you of any joy that you can have. But you know what you're going to tell me? Well, that's all stuff from Gnosticism from way back in 85 AD. We don't battle that today, right? Why would I bring that up? Well, you know, that's just the situation John wrote. If we had a book today, not a First John, if we had a letter to our church, right, would there be any issues, any situations that we would have to look at to say, wow, this is really an issue that maybe in my mind, or I've heard other people speak, that sets us up in a situation where we think, you know what, we can do this, still have fellowship. We can do this, still be in the light. 60 years later, right? We've been, as I look out, many of us have been on a long walk, a long journey since that day of baptism. A lot of things have been introduced. A lot of things have changed. A lot of things we've been caught up with, you know, as a group, as a church. Some things that we've been involved with. Have you heard over the years things where we've gotten ourselves sideways? You know, whether it's a Passover controversy, or whether it's what God really requires. You know, what does God really require? Whether we get into a name of God situation, or whether we get what day we keep this or that. Some things that get us to a different spot, that maybe puts us not in true fellowship with God the Father and Jesus Christ. Things that can separate us from the fellowship that John, different time, different era. But I bring what John was addressing here. We have our own issues to address. The things that creep in from time to time that are presented in a certain way as part of the fellowship. But we have to be very careful in our era, in our time now, as we embark on our walk and our journey. So this afternoon, in the time I have left, I just want to ask a couple questions. Because if John's going to say, and I'm going to read this and say, if he's saying joy comes by being in fellowship with God the Father and Jesus Christ, I want to say, how do I get there? Am I in fellowship, right? Because I want to be in that spot. How do you get there, right? I want a formula. I want to figure out what do I need to do? Because he's saying, come and be in fellowship with us. That's where you find joy. So I guess I'd ask this afternoon, how do I know if I am in fellowship with God? And how can I increase that fellowship? Because it is something I think that's at certain times we fellowship better than others with God the Father and Jesus Christ. So how do we get there and how do we increase it? Look at John, the second chapter. We're going to spend, as you can see, a lot of time in the book of John. He says in chapter 2, my little children, these things I write to you so that you may not sin. Right? Because he's saying, if I want you to have joy, I want you not to sin. Now, he also realizes, boy, you heard in the sermonette, that's our goal, right? So if we just say that, okay, go home, don't sin. Right? That's our goal. That's our goal for the rest of your life. Well, we're not going to get there. Right? John was a realist as well. He's saying, ideally, I write you these things so we would go on a path, so we wouldn't sin. But he says, but if anyone sins, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ, the righteous, and he himself is the propitiation for our sins. So he says, if that happens, here's another thing. When you look back, I think, at this holiday season, you realize what God does for us. It's God does this for us. God does this to us. God reconciles us. God calls us into his fellowship. God defends us. God is that sacrifice we keep going back to when we sin. All he says in the first chapter around verse 8 is, if we sin, just confess that. Right? Just confess. Confess and he is quick to forgive. He had a whole group of people that wouldn't confess their sin. They had elevated beyond that and they were fine. And they had their own system worked out and they were above this whole process. But he's saying, no, this is the pathway. Fellowship with God when we sin. Call on his name. Confess your sins. He's quick there. He'll go to the Father to defend, and we're restored. That restoration of fellowship now is back in place. He says that's another part of the formula. But now he says, what do we do? How do we know that we are truly in fellowship walking with God? Look what he says in verse 3 of chapter 2. By this we know that we know him. Right? There's the start of a formula. I like that. Right? By this we know that we know him. By this he's going to show us. We know that we know. We know that we're really partnered with him, that we're an associate of his, and that we are living with him if we do some of the following things that John talks about. Look what he says there in verse 3. We know if we know him if we keep his commandments. Number 1. If we keep his commandments, hey, I'm not reinventing the wheel here this afternoon with that one, right? That should be at the core foundation of our spiritual building. But you can understand the time that John wrote, it really wasn't there. You know what? I can establish certain things that I think are good enough, or my own thinking, my own knowledge-based thought process. But he says, no, you know, when you get back to it at the end of the day, it comes back to walking in the light. And John, 60 years later, harkens back to something. We'll just turn here in the book of John. I'm sure, can you imagine writing the letter about 1955? Some of you probably couldn't do that. You weren't around yet. But if you had to go back to that time and you walked with Jesus Christ, right, what is John conjuring up? He's conjuring up the words of his master. Right? Go back to John 14. We read this Thursday night at the Passover. Well, let's just take a look. It's powerful because it's a first-hand account of Jesus. Not something John read in the book, not even something he read in the newspaper, but John was there. He heard. He lived it. He saw it. In John 14, verse 15, what does Jesus say that's recorded in the book of John? If you love me, keep my commandments. Verse 21, he who has my commandments and keeps them, it is he who loves me. It is he who is in partnership, in fellowship with me. It is that person who abides in me. And he who loves me will be loved by my Father, and I will love him and manifest myself to him. John, just going back to the words of Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ, when he wrote that, and he said, you know what, if you really want to be in fellowship, if you want to be known by God or know that we know God, start with keeping his commandments. You know, when I think about it nowadays, it's becoming increasingly difficult to do that as we see the world around. I was recounting a while back when I thought when we grew up as children, we had the world around us at that time had a very, very similar, at least, sense of morality, a sense of ethics, a sense of family, a sense of a higher being. And I look out at our young people today, and it's anything but that. It's a difficult road because not only is the path that we have, and we sit here today, a little different than most professing Christians, but on top of that, the world around us doesn't even look at this with any kind of reverence. It's actually looked upon in a very, very derogatory sense. I see that. Having teenagers and a son who's in college, it's not just, you know, an occasional comment. It is an agenda. It is an aggressive agenda. It's a hostile agenda that wants to silence this word. It wants to silence anything that would say, follow those commands. Live a certain way. Live for God. That is just not anywhere in the equation. It's much more difficult. It's an easier way to rationalize. Remember I said these Gnostics with knowledge? Boy, is there a knowledge system that's set up there now that can rationalize any position apart from God and still say, you know what, I'm doing some pretty good things still. Right? It's an easy thing to have to start washing over us. You know, I even taught to my daughter on certain days, it's difficult. It's a wearing down like water over rock. It just keeps coming and coming and coming. Right, to destroy. That's a powerful agenda that is not by happenstance. It's not without purpose. It's intended. It's intended to wash over and to drown out the commands, the words of God the Father and Jesus Christ, to say, no, 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 no. There's a whole different acceptable way to get there. I had a discussion with a coworker, and you ever find yourself getting to one of these discussions, you got halfway and you go, whoa, I got in like a lot deeper than I wanted to. Right? And it was a lot more animated, and now I found myself quite animated. And we were talking about some of the current issues that are out there in the LGBT, you know, movement and situation there. And I was trying to state the case about marriage and man and woman. And he was like, he just could not believe how narrow-minded that was, right? Narrow-minded, the way God has set something up that's holy, sanctified, and yet it's thrown to the garbage by so many people nowadays. Look at our governor. Look how he is being dragged through the mud. And so before that conversation, it was over. You know what he threw back to me? He said, you know what? At the end of the day, doesn't the same Bible say God is love? That trumps everything. Right? See that thought process? Yeah, but what's wrong with me? Right? God is love. Can't you see beyond? Why? That is a powerful, seducing argument that's out there, not only for our young people, but for all of us. When you think about that, it's out there to twist that. See, John addressed certain things back then, but we have some very, very real issues that are there as well today that look to intercept, to destroy that fellowship we have with God the Father and Jesus Christ. But John says, you know, as a starting point, we have to obey. We have to have diligence, as we heard in the sermonette. We have to call on God the Father and say, God, give us the courage to stand for your commands, which are difficult. Increasingly, I am shocked at the speed of how quickly things are moving away from any kind of moral compass, any kind of basis where we can stand and have commonality with the person next to us. Not here at church, hopefully, no. But I mean, it's really difficult. It's growing that way. And that argument is thrown out that, you know, yeah, God is love. So, I mean, you have to be bigger minded than that. Can't you see that? And then all the labels that follow afterwards. That's the world we're talking about. That's the difficulty. You know, and I think, again, we jot down, and Philippians 2 is one of those memorization chapters and verses where I think about, yeah, what I'm describing is difficult, right? But again, we always go to Jesus Christ, our elder brother, where he was obedient to the point of death. Right? Obedient. We haven't had to suffer that way. But sometimes I think about it, you know, he's called us into partnership. And sometimes it's easy to be a silent partner. Isn't it? Easy to be a silent. And that's what's so frustrating sometimes, because it is hard. Society is doing everything to squelch us and put us on the sideline. I'm not saying we go into the fray for persecution's sake, but there are times when we will have to stand in the middle of a command or what God wants us to stand for. These are the times that we are in, to partner with God. And he was obedient to the time of death. I even think when it comes to what he's saying, obey my commands, you know, I think it's easier as time goes on too. And again, this is my thought process, so bear with me if it doesn't hit your spot exactly. But it's easy for us, I think, as long as we've been in the church, we can check off some of those big boxes, right? We turned in an offering envelope today. We show up for the holy days. Right, we do a lot of things to serve God. But then it comes down to, you know, that last weed or, you know, the little things. You know, how attentive is my ear still to every last instruction? How attentive am I really wanting to line up and obey when I hear, you know what, clear your books and put them on the side. And I got to talk over here first. I got some important stuff. Right? Am I still in that spot with those little things? Right, to want to obey God's command, to have a yielded heart. Because it's easy as time goes on. I got this collective body of work. I'm checking all the big boxes. Can I have like 3, 4, or 5 of these still that I just sort of hang on to? But he's saying, and we look at Jesus Christ with that instantaneous wanting, desire to obey. What a wonderful thing it is when we see that spirit in the little things. And I found it myself even during this Passover season. One night my wife was running some errands and I had some work to get done. I think some people were going to come over and she said, can you just pass the vacuum, right, on the first floor? And I said, what's a vacuum, first of all? No. But she said, can you pass? So I had my own agenda, right? I had certain things I had to get done. Like he's talking about the weeds today. I'm like, he's bringing up weed. Now I'm thinking about my yard, right? So you get fixated, right? But I'll have to ask him what he spoke about later, because once he said weed, I was thinking about my, it was good. But, so I'm thinking, you know, it's all weather. I gotta get outside. I gotta do this. As I'm doing more and more of my stuff, I'm like, but if she comes home and I haven't passed a vacuum, right? So you're playing this little game. But again, it's even little stuff like that, submitting one to another and saying, you know what? Let me do that first. If I get my stuff in, I get it in. But that willingness, that back and forth with each other, submitting one to another, we do that when we make, when I occasionally cook. It's funny because my wife is an excellent cook and Anna's coming quickly in her footsteps, and I'll put something in. They'll say, no, that can't be rounded. It can't be a rounded teaspoon. It's got to be just perfect. And I want to throw it in, right? Because what difference does it make? What difference? Whether I put 3 cups of chocolate chips in or I mean, you only want one, right? It doesn't really matter. It's going to be good. Little things. I think as time goes on, we see that in ourselves sometimes, and it can go into other areas of our life. You know, that little thing. Look in verse 5, what John says in 1 John 2. 1 John 2, verse 5, he says, "But whoever keeps his word, truly the love of God is perfected in him. And by this we know that we are in him." So he says, if you keep those words, the love of God, you know what that word perfected means? It means complete, fulfilled, finished. Is that unbelievable? We are to be a vessel of God's love. Right? If you keep his words, and it's all, again, to me it's all formula related, because God's laws are love. If we keep those laws in obedience, guess what we're going to become? Love. Perfected, completed, that he came and Jesus Christ gave everything in love to us as the example. He lives in us now. If we follow him, can it end anywhere else except in love? That obedience factor is so important. I remember back when we were Ambassador College, and we would have, some of you probably are familiar with that, twice a week foreman assemblies, and they would go through different things, and they would bring up sometimes situations where students had done things. And I remember certain voices, well, not voices, but I don't hear voices, but certain things I can still, occasionally, but certain things I can hear still. And I remember being at one of those points, and he brought up several things, and he goes, "Some of you always want to feel that you're the exception. Right? You're the exception. Right? I always got a reason why I can't 100% line up. Right? But when we have that willingness, when we're in fellowship with God, we want to do that. It's a beautiful spirit when you see that. And it's manifested in love. What a wonderful thing he's talking about here. That our life begins to emanate now and reflect him. Reflect him in every way. It's a tall order. It's a very tall order. But we're called to be a manifestation of love. I want to read an article. Some of you may have heard this before. And I think we have enough time. I'll just read about, it's called The Cab Driver and the Old Lady. It's from a New York City taxi cab driver. He wrote, "I arrived at the address and honked the horn. After waiting a few minutes, I honked again. Since this was going to be the last ride of my shift, I thought about just driving away, but instead I put the car in park and walked up to the door and knocked. 'Just a minute,' answered a frail, elderly voice. I could hear something being dragged across the floor. After a long pause, the door opened. A small woman in her 90s stood before me. She was wearing a print dress and a pillbox hat with a veil pinned on it, like something out of a 1940s movie. By her side was a small nylon suitcase. The apartment looked as if no one had lived in it for years. All the furniture was covered with sheets. There were no clocks on the walls, no knickknacks or utensils on the counter. In the corner was a cardboard box filled with photos and glassware. 'Would you carry my bag out to the car?' she asked. I took the cab suitcase to the cab, then returned to assist her. She took my arm. We walked slowly to the curb. She kept thanking me for my kindness. 'It's nothing,' I told her. 'I just want to treat my passengers the way I would want my mother to be treated.' 'Oh, you're such a good boy,' she said. When we got in the cab, she gave me an address and then asked, 'Could you drive me through downtown?' 'It's not the shortest way,' I answered quickly. 'Oh, I don't mind,' she said. 'I'm in no hurry. I'm on my way to a hospice.' I looked in the rearview mirror. Her eyes were glistening. 'I don't have any family left,' she continued in a soft voice. 'The doctor says I don't have very long.' I reached over and shut off the meter. 'What route would you like me to take?' I asked. For the next 2 hours, we drove through the city. She showed me the building where she had once worked as an elevator operator. We drove through the neighborhood where she and her husband had lived when they were newlyweds. She had me pull up front of a furniture warehouse that had once been a ballroom where she had gone dancing as a girl. Sometimes she'd ask me to slow in front of a particular building or corner and would sit staring in the darkness, saying nothing. At the first hint of sun was creasing on the horizon, she suddenly said, 'I'm tired. Let's go now.' We drove in silence to the address she had given me. It was a low building, like a small convalescent home, with a driveway that passed under a portico. When we pulled up, they were waiting for us. They were watching her every move. They must have been expecting her. I opened the trunk and took a small suitcase to the door. The woman was already seated in a wheelchair. 'How much do I owe you?' she asked, reaching into her purse. 'Nothing,' I said. 'You have to make a living,' she answered. Almost without thinking, I bent and gave her a hug. She held on to me tightly. You gave an old woman a moment of joy, she said. Thank you. I squeezed her hand and then walked into the dim morning light. Behind me, a door shut. It was the sound of the closing of a life. I didn't pick up any more passengers that shift. I drove aimlessly, lost in thought. For the rest of that day, I could hardly talk. What if that woman had gotten an angry driver or one that was impatient to end his shift? What if I had refused to take the run or had honked once and then driven away? On a quick review, I don't think that I have done anything more important in my life. We're conditioned to think that our lives revolve around great moments, but great moments also often catch us unaware, beautifully wrapped in what others may consider a small one. Called to be a vessel of love. Called to make a difference. Called to give back that same love that Jesus Christ and God the Father so freely gave to us as we're in fellowship and service to Him, wrapped up in His cause as a partner of His, living our lives for Him. What else does John say if we want to fellowship with God the Father and Jesus Christ? Verse 6 of John chapter 2. The second point he brings out. He who says he abides in Him ought to walk just as He walked. I think it's interesting that word ought, I think in modern vernacular, say, you know, I ought to do that at some point. I oughta, right? I ought to do this. But that word actually means to be under an obligation. To be bound, to be a debtor, to be indebted to owe. You know, if we say we owe Him, the one who gave His life for us, we not only say, you know what, I probably should get around to that, as we heard in the sermon, I probably should do that, I ought to live that way. He's saying, no, we're bound to do that. We have a debt, an obligation to walk as Jesus Christ walked. We could spend a lot of time going through that, because there's so much there in terms of how He walked and the example He gave for us. And that's why it's such a great thing that we point our eyes only to Jesus Christ. Because if we look around, we get all messed up, right? That our walk is better or worse than somebody else. But it's that standard that's laid out there. I just want to read something from a movie that I'm sure many of you are familiar with, Saving Private Ryan from 1998. And I want to invoke the spoiler alert statute of limitations on this one, because every time people say, oh, that's a spoiler alert, don't say that. So, I mean, 1998, all right, that's 18 years ago. So if I'm giving it away, I'm sorry. All right, I'll just say that up front. But as most of you know, it was about Saving Private Ryan, as the title says. And he was saved by Captain Miller, who gave his life. And as it was a really poignant scene, as he was dying, he just asked him to live his life well. And so later, many, many years later, this Private Ryan went to Captain Miller's gravesite. And he spent some time, his family was with him, and he separated himself, and he walked over there. And this is what he said as he was standing by his gravesite, Private Ryan, addressing Captain Miller's grave. He said, my family is with me today. They wanted to come with me. To be honest with you, I wasn't sure how I'd feel coming back here. Every day I think about what you said to me that day on the bridge. I tried to live my life the best I could. I hope that was enough. I hope that, at least in your eyes, I've earned what all of you have done for me. I hope that was enough, that we ought to walk like Jesus Christ. I think about that often, and thinking about looking back and saying, Jesus, I hope that was enough. Not that it earns any salvation. We know that that's not at all what it's about. But he's saying, if we want to be in partnership, if we want to be really working in lockstep, we'd live the way you lived, that you gave your life, and that one day we say, Jesus, I hope that was enough. I hope I live my life in a way that was in partnership with you, in fellowship with you. And sometimes I think about this when I think, you know, you get so busy during the course of the week and you have these great intentions. I say, I can't even get a card out, right? You wonder sometimes about living and giving that debt of gratitude and walking in a way where Jesus Christ was all about certain things that we need to embody and set a bar for. And I think about this week and this week of unleavened bread, that we have things that we can just dedicate ourselves to just wanting to live that way. And I see so many great examples all the time in our congregation of people who are doing those things, who are walking as Jesus Christ did. And it's encouraging. It's encouraging that we would want to live as he did. We're called to do that. And that's, again, remember, it's joy. It brings joy when we live that way. That's the only true joy that's there, because we're doing God the Father and Jesus Christ's work. What a wonderful opportunity that we have another day, another opportunity to do that and to live that way. You can just jot down a couple of things from Jesus when we say, how did Jesus live? Compassion. Wow. Wouldn't it be great? And some of you are wonderful examples. Wonderful examples of compassion. I write down my own, this is my own little personal checklist. If you've already got it checked off, you're in a good spot. But for me, I just think about that compassion. You know, and sometimes it's, you know, you have these discussions where Passover season's interesting. You're supposed to examine yourself, but a lot of times your wife helps you with that process, which is good. Her Bible, she has the wife application Bible, and it says, examine yourself and your husband, right? But she'll tell me sometimes, she'll say, and I say, what did I say that wasn't right? It was your tone. Right? It was your tone. Right? So we're there all day, you're stressed, you're doing, I need this done. Right? It's tone. Right? So compassion. When we think about Jesus Christ, you know, the woman caught in sin, right? How Jesus Christ handled that. You think of how he was with Mary, with Lazarus, when Lazarus died. Compassion. The little children, where he said, no. Let him come. Bring those children to me. He had time. He had a gentleness. Had a compassion. We need to walk as he walked. Forgiveness. Forgiveness, 70 times 7, when Jesus Christ said, we forgive. We become a people, and I said that before, if I forgave 490 times to the same person, well, there'd be a problem, first of all. But if we did that 490 times, you wouldn't have to be reminded to forgive. That's who you are. Right? That's who we would become. That we'd have nothing there that would cause division. What is there for us not to forgive, and we've been forgiven everything? When we think about that this week and we say, what am I holding back on? What can't I forgive? What's the big hurt that's caused me so much great pain and someone's caused me so much offense? Really? It's easy for us to get into that spot. Again, this is my list. Jotted down a couple of things here as I thought about that. An example of Jesus Christ gave us of humility, where he divested everything. I heard a good comment this week about, you know, Jesus Christ, he suffered greatly. But the other thing was, when he came here, he had divested himself of his glory. And not knowing that if he would ever have that back with the Father again. Right? He came here to take that and put it all in play, at risk. Because he humbled himself and came here to live a way to give us an example how to live. Wonderful things as we talk about walking as he did. Let's look at the last thing that John points out here in terms of fellowship. Fellowship with God the Father and Jesus Christ. 1 John 2 in verse 9. He who says he is in the light and hates his brother is in darkness until now. He who loves his brother abides in the light, and there is no cause for stumbling in him. But he who hates his brother is in darkness and walks in darkness and does not know where he is going, because the darkness has blinded him. If we are in true fellowship with God the Father and Jesus Christ, we love our brother. It's interesting what John here, it's black and white. He doesn't say either you love your brother, you hate your brother. Right? Sometimes we like to straddle that in-between spot, right? And I use a collective we again. I am speaking, right? I am speaking. It's easy to say, yeah, I don't get along the best with them, or they're a little annoying, or I don't deal with them a lot, or I don't always talk with them, right? We get this in-between ground. What John would say, you hate your brother, right? Because you're not acting in love at that point. And it's interesting where he says in verse 9, you're in darkness. We can't get around that. We're in darkness. Darkness equals no fellowship with God, equals no joy. Right? Have you been in a spot where you've been detached from a situation or a person We can rationalize and get comfortable with it, but at the end of the day, something's been robbed. Something's been stripped. That feeling there is like, you know, there's something there that's not quite right. That's joy that's been stripped away. But he says in verse 10, he who loves his brother abides in the light, and there's no cause for stumbling in him. Right? There's no cause, because now your spiritual life is not impacted. You're not going to stumble in a way. Where he talks about in verse 11, there's blindness. You're in darkness. And he doesn't know where he's going. Because you know, when you get to that spot, when you're blinded, your judgment becomes obscured. Doesn't it? Because everything now is colored in a very bad spot against that person. You'll even not support things because, oh, it was that person. Or that, oh, see, it's all there and it all is darkness. And we have a funny way, humanly, to rationalize all that and get ourselves, because we've got to get comfortable with our own self. And we've compartmentalized that a little bit. John says, no, no, no. It's black and white. This lightness, darkness, love, hate. 100%, 0%. And so he says, if you want to be in unison, you have to do that. You have to, because that's pretty telling in chapter 4. What does he say in 1 John 4 and verse 20? First John 4 and verse 20. If someone says, I love God, because that's the thing we would all say, right? If we had a sheet with a box on it and said, you love God? Check. I love God. Of course I do. And hates his brother. He says, you're a liar. John does not mince what he says here. He says, those two are incompatible. You're a liar. For he who does not love his brother whom he has seen, how can he love God whom he has not seen? And this commandment, again, a commandment now from God, we have from him, that he who loves God must love his brother also, because God loves mankind. If we have that love of God that emanates in our relationships to others, then how can we hold something that like that against our brother? He says it's the two don't work together. If we walk in the light, we love our brother. What a great opportunity we have for whatever situation we might find ourselves in to increase in that fellowship with one another through Jesus Christ. And that's why we take any situation that short-circuits that process back to God first, right? Because we know when we fellowship with God the Father and Jesus Christ, guess what? Our fellowship with each other tends to work a lot better. Right? We know that. We say, wait, I got an issue here. Well, I probably have an issue here. Right? Because I'm out of sync with God. I'm not fellowship. I'm not walking, listening, and abiding by his words that says, go and forgive your brother. Go turn your cheek. Go suffer loss. Go be a servant. And then walk as I did. And then guess what? Your brother's going to look pretty good. What a great formula that's laid out for us. So it's a wonderful thing that John writes about, and John is someone who walked with Jesus Christ, spent 3.5 years with Jesus Christ, is the one that, I love the way he wrote this, the disciple that Jesus loved. I guess if you get to write the book, you have editorial license, right? The one that Jesus loved. But that's also the one where Jesus, when he was on the cross with Mary, was there, he says, behold, your mother, the one he left John to. John writes about love 18 times in the first book of John, more than any other book in the Bible, and it's not that long a book. He talks about concepts that are vitally important to us today. So whatever situation he was addressing with the Gnostic belief, we have our own situations today. In a world that's growing increasingly dark, increasingly difficult to walk in the light, in a world that's increasingly seducing us to rationalize, hey, God's love, what's your problem? That trumps everything. I have the trump card, and I define what love is now. Right? Isn't a world redefining love? It's an open mind and acceptance and tolerance of everything except this. That's where we sit today. That's the pressures that are against us. That's the pressures against our young people. That's the pressures against us as we walk. But John came back and said, here's the formula. I want you to have joy, full joy. Because if we spin in that cycle we described, our joy is stripped. Have you felt ever in a week that your joy got stripped? That you were worn down? That you got to a spot where the world and all these things we're talking about, where darkness crept in, your feelings, your emotions went a certain way? It's because the recipe is here for us. And John wrote about that and wants us to have that complete and full joy. That is possible through Jesus Christ and God the Father. So it's my hope for all of us this week, these days of unleavened bread, as we have now Jesus Christ living in us, that we would take full advantage of that fellowship, that partnership that he's called us to be a part of his work. And I hear those words from Mr. Armstrong at the time. I'd always hear that term, do the work, do the work. Well, that work is being done in us, which is great, because Jesus Christ, I'm going to call you into fellowship so I can do a work in you. You can come become an extension of me, a vessel of my love. Live in a way that glorifies me, and I also want you to partner with others in a way that expands the family. What a wonderful thing that is laid out to us. And this week, as we take advantage of that, that will only unify us. And our fellowship then increases with each other, because as our bond truly is through Jesus Christ and God the Father and what he's done, and then we have unity together as his body. So let's have a great week of Unleavened Bread.